a city with enough industry that they could find work, and with apartments to house what was left of the family, including her parents, whom she had convinced to stay in Villeneuve until the war was officially over. Vooch, Helena heard, had apartments, jobs, and a Red Cross office. And sure enough, it didn't take her long to find a place to live when they arrived. The city's ghetto had been liquidated later than most, which meant there were hundreds of vacant homes in the old Jewish quarter, and not enough Poles to fill them. It was nauseating to consider what had become of the families who had lived there before them. But Helena knew they couldn't afford to rent in the city center. She selected two neighboring apartments, the most spacious she could find. They were missing half of their furniture, but there were so many empty homes she was able to salvage enough pieces here and there to make them habitable. The family is quiet as Jakob arranges five chairs in a semicircle around the fireplace, where the radio is perched like a tombstone atop the mantel. "Sit, love," he says, gesturing to Bella. She lowers herself gently into the chair, rests a hand on the subtle curve of her stomach. She is 6 months pregnant. Mila, Helena, Adam, and Jakob sit too, while Felicia curls up on the floor, wincing as she pulls her knees to her chest. Mila combs her fingers through Felicia's hair, which has begun to grow in its natural red at the roots. It breaks her heart to see her daughter in pain. The scurvy she'd contracted in the convent bunker has cleared up for the most part, but she still complains of an ache in her joints. At least, Mila sighs, her appetite is back. Felicia had refused food for weeks when Mila first retrieved her, claiming that it hurt too much to eat. Finally, the voice of Harry Truman, the United States' new president, spills from the radio speakers, and the family leans in. "This is a solemn but glorious hour," Truman projects through a sea of static. The local broadcaster translates. "General Eisenhower," Truman continues, "informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations." He pauses for effect and then adds, "The flags of freedom fly all over Europe." The words freedom and fly reverberate through the room, drifting overhead like confetti. The family stares at the radio and then at one another as the president's alliteration comes to rest tentatively on their laps. Adam removes his glasses and lifts his chin toward the ceiling, pinching the bridge of his nose between his thumb and forefinger. Bella wipes a tear from her eye, and Jakob reaches for her hand. Mila bites her lip. Felicia looks around at the others and then up at her mother, her eyes inquisitive, unsure why they are crying at what she understood to be good news. Helena tries to picture the American president, seated triumphantly behind his desk, some 6,000 kilometers west of them. VE Day, Truman called it. Victory in Europe. But to Helena, the word victory feels hollow. False, even. There's hardly anything victorious about the ruined Warsaw they left, or about the fact that so many of the family is still missing, or about how all around them, in what was once Vojvodina's massive ghetto, they can feel the ghost of 200,000 Jews, most of whom, it's rumored, met their deaths in the gas vans and chambers of Chełmno and Auschwitz. A muffled cheer trickles in from the apartment next door. Through the window, a few shouts from the street. Vooch has begun to celebrate. The world has begun to celebrate. Hitler has been defeated. The war is over. Which means, technically, they are free to be Kurtzes and Eichenwalds and Keilers again. To be Jews again. But the mood in the apartment isn't celebratory. Not while the rest of the family is unaccounted for. And not with so many dead. Every day the estimated toll rises. First it was 1 million. Then 2. Numbers so large, they can't even begin to grasp the enormity of it. When Truman's speech is over, The Polish announcer states that the Red Cross will continue to erect dozens of offices and displaced persons camps throughout Europe, urging survivors to register themselves. Adam switches the radio off, and the living room goes quiet again. What is there to say? Finally, it is Halina who fills the silence. "Tomorrow," she declares, willing her voice to remain steady, "I return to the Red Cross. Double-check that all of our names are registered. I'll ask about the DP camps and when exactly we will be able to access a list of names. And I'll begin making arrangements to reach mother and father in the countryside." On the street below, the cheering grows louder. Halina stands and makes her way to the window, slides it gently closed. Chapter 55. The Kurz Family. Łódź, Poland, June, 1945. Every day, Halina walks the familiar route from the apartment in Łódź, first to the temporary Red Cross headquarters in the center of town, then to the newly erected offices of the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, and finally to the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, or the Joint, as everyone calls it, in hopes of discovering news of missing family. When she isn't making her rounds, she scours the local daily, which has begun publishing lists of names and classified ads from survivors looking for relatives. The radio, too, has a station devoted to helping survivors reconnect. She's called in twice. Last week, Halina's hopes soared when she discovered Franka's name on a list published by the Central Committee of Jews in Poland, an organization funded by the Joint Distribution Committee. Franka had been sent, along with her brother and her parents, to a camp outside of Lublin called Majdanek. By some unexplained twist of fate, she, Salek, and Terza had survived. Her father Moishe, however, had not been so fortunate. Halina has begun trying to make arrangements for her cousins and aunt to come to Łódź, but she's been told it could take months. They are among thousands of refugees awaiting assistance at the DP camp where they've been stationed. Halina's parents, at least, are here now in Łódź. She'd managed to retrieve them at last from the country. "They must be getting bored with me," Halina reckons, as she approaches the offices of the Red Cross, where the volunteers know her well. They typically greet her with a half-smile, a head-shake, and a doleful, "sorry, no news." Today, though, the aluminum door has barely swung closed behind her when one of the volunteers rushes at her. "It's for you!" the woman shrieks, waving a small white paper overhead. A dozen or so people turn. In a space usually filled with sadness, the excitement in the woman's voice is jarring. Halina stops, looks over her shoulder and then back at the volunteer. "For me? What's for me?" "This!" The volunteer holds a telegram between thumbs and forefingers at arm's length, then reads it aloud. "With Selim in Italy. Find us through Polish Second Corps. Gene Kurz." At the sound of her brother's name, the room begins to spin and Halina splays her arms reflexively to keep from falling. "What? Where is he?" Her voice is shaky. "Let me see that." She reaches for the telegram, dizzy. "The Polish Second Corps? Isn't that Anders' army? With Selim? Who they all thought was dead?" Halina can barely breathe. General Anders is all anyone in Łódź can talk about. He and his men are heroes. They took Monte Cassino, fought on the River Senio in the Battle of Bologna. Halina shakes her head, trying to picture Genek and her brother-in-law Selim in uniform, in battle, making history. But she can't. "See for yourself." Halina grips the telegram so tightly the beads of her thumbnails go white. She prays there isn't some kind of mistake. "With Selim in Italy. Find us through Polish Second Corps. Gene Kurz." Sure enough, her brother's name is spelled across the bottom. She looks up. The others watch, awaiting a reaction. Halina opens her mouth and then closes it, swallowing what might be a sob or a laugh. She can't tell which.
"Thank you,"
she finally croaks, clutching the telegram to her chest. "Thank you." The office swells with cheers as Halina brings the telegram to her lips, kisses it over and over again. Tears begin to spill down her cheeks, but she ignores them. A single thought fills her mind. There is no mistake. They are alive. She tucks the telegram into her blouse pocket, spins out of the office, and takes off running. 12 blocks later, she scales the stairs leading to her apartment in Tuz and finds her parents in the kitchen preparing dinner. Her mother looks up as Halina peers at them through the doorway, panting, her cheeks flushed. "Are you okay?" Nahuma asks, alarmed, her knife suspended over a carrot. "Have you been crying?" Halina doesn't know where to begin. "Is Mila home?" she asks, breathless. "She went to the market with Felicia. She'll be back in a minute. Halina, what is it?" Nahuma sets the knife down and wipes her hands on a dish towel tucked into the waistband of her skirt. Beside her, Saul goes still. "Halina, tell us what's happened." He looks at Halina closely, his brow pinched with worry.
I have news," Halina exclaims. "How long ago did Mila?"
She stops short at the sound of a door opening.
"Mila!"
Racing to the foyer, she greets her sister at the door, grabbing a canvas tote from her arms.
"Thank goodness you're here. Come, hurry."
"Why are you so out of breath?" Mila asks. "You're soaked in sweat."
"News. I have news."
Mila's eyes pop. The hazel of her irises, surrounded suddenly by a sea of white.
"What? What kind of news?"
News could mean anything. She and Felicia follow Halina down the hallway. At the door to the kitchen, Halina motions for her parents to join her in the living room.
"Come,"
she calls. When the family is gathered, Halina takes a deep breath. She can barely contain herself.
"I've just come from the Red Cross," she says, reaching into her blouse pocket and extracting the telegram.
She wills her hands to remain steady as she holds the priceless piece of paper up for her family to see.
"It came in today, from Italy."
She reads the telegram aloud, enunciating every word carefully.
"With Selim, in Italy. Find us through Polish Second Corps."
She looks up at her mother, her father, her sister, Felicia, her eyes dancing between them, filling up again with tears.
"Signed, Gemme Kurz,"
she adds, her voice cracking.
"What?"
Mila pulls Felicia to her, cradling her head against her low ribs. Nehuma reaches for Saul's arm to steady herself.
"Read that again," Saul whispers.
Halina reads the telegram again and once again. By the third read, Nehuma is in tears, and the small apartment is filled with a deep clap of Saul's laughter.
"That is the best news I've heard since I can remember," he says, his shoulders shaking.
They hug in pairs, Saul and Nehuma, Mila and Felicia, Mila and Halina, Halina and Nehuma, and then huddle together as one, like a giant wheel, hands wrapped around waists and foreheads pressed up against one another's, Felicia tucked somewhere in the middle. Time disappears as they hold each other, laughing and crying, Saul reciting the telegram's 12 perfect words over and over and over again. Halina is the first to pull free from the circle.
"Jakob," she shrieks, "I must go tell Jakob."
"Yes, go," Nehuma says, drying her eyes.
"Tell him to meet us here for supper this evening."
"I will," Halina calls, flying down the hallway. The door opens and then closes, and soon after, a hush falls over the apartment.
"Mamushu?"
Felicia whispers, peering up at her mother as if awaiting an explanation. But Mila has gone silent. Her gaze volleys left to right, as if searching the room for something she can't see. A ghost, perhaps. Noticing, Nehuma rests a hand on Saul's shoulder. "Could you prepare some tea with Felicia?" she whispers. Saul glances at Mila and nods, beckoning Felicia to the kitchen. When they are alone, Nehuma turns to Mila, reaches for her arm. "Mila, what is it, darling?" Mila blinks, shakes her head. "It's nothing, Mother, I just..." "Come," Nehuma offers, guiding Mila to the small table in the living room where they take their meals. Mila moves slowly, her mind elsewhere as she sits. Resting her elbows on the table, she wraps her hands together into a giant fist and leans her chin into her thumbs. For a while, neither woman speaks. "It's not what you were expecting, to find him," Nehuma finally says, choosing her words carefully. "You didn't think he was still alive?"
"No."
A tear slips from the corner of Mila's eye, rolls down her cheek. Nehuma brushes it gently away.
"You must be relieved, though, yes?"
Mila nods.
"Of course."
She lifts her chin, turns to face her mother.
"It's just that I've spent the last 6 years thinking he was dead. I'd adjusted to it, accepted it even, as terrible as that sounds."
"It's understandable. You had to go on for Felicia's sake. You did what any mother would do."
"I shouldn't have given up on him. I should have been more hopeful. What kind of wife gives up on her husband?"
"Please," Nehuma says, her voice soft, understanding. "What were you supposed to think? You didn't hear from him. We all thought he was dead. Besides, none of that matters now." Mila glances over her shoulder toward the kitchen. "I need to talk to Felicia." Mila had spoken less and less of Selim since admitting to Felicia she was unsure of his fate, since choosing for her own sake to believe that he was gone. But Felicia had refused to let go. She'd spent the past year asking questions about him, begging her mother for details. "She's built him up so much in her mind," Mila adds. "What if she's disappointed? When he left, she was just a baby, healthy, pink-cheeked. What if..." Mila stops, unable to describe how much Felicia has changed. Nehuma reaches for Mila's hands, lays her palms over them. "Mila, darling, I know all of this is sudden, but think of it this way. You've been given a chance, a precious, impossible chance to start over. And Selim is Felicia's father. She will love him, and he will love her just the way you love her, unconditionally." Mila nods. "You're right," she whispers. "I just hate that he doesn't know her." "Give him time," Nehuma says, "and yourself time, to figure it out again. How to be a family. Be patient. Try not to worry too much about it. You've done enough worrying for a lifetime." Mila slips her hands from under her mother's to wipe a tear from her cheek. What does it mean, she wonders, to live a day of her life without worry, without a plan? Every minute of every day has been orchestrated to the best of her ability since the start of the war. Is she even capable, Mila wonders, of letting things unfold on their own? Later that evening, once Felicia is asleep, the family sits at the dinner table, studying a map spread out before them. Helena has sent a telegram to Genek, letting him know that for the most part, the family is alive and well. "Still no word from Adi," she wrote. "When are you discharged? Where should we meet?" The exercise of deciding where to go next is difficult, because next most likely means a new forever. It means thinking about where to settle, where to start over. During the war, their options were fewer, the stakes higher, their mission singular. It was simple in a way. Keep your chin down, your guard up, stay one step ahead, stay alive for one more day. Don't let the enemy win. To think about a long-term plan feels complicated and burdensome, like flexing an atrophied muscle. The first question, Alina says, looking around the table, is, do we stay in Poland? Saul shakes his head. His eyes are stern. Despite the news from Genek in Italy, he has found very few reasons lately to smile. 2 weeks ago, not long after learning of his brother-in-law Moshe's death, he'd discovered that a sister, two brothers, four cousins, and half a dozen nieces and nephews who had been living in Krakow at the start of the war had also been killed. His extended family, once so large, has been reduced to just a few. The news had wrecked him. He presses the pad of his index finger to the table. Here, he says, frowning, we are not safe. The others sit silently, considering what they do and do not know. The Germans have surrendered, yes, but for Jewish survivors, the war is far from over. Already, the Kurtzes have heard stories of Jews returning to their hometowns, only to be accosted, robbed, sometimes killed. In one instance, a pogrom erupted when a group of locals accused a returning Jewish man of kidnapping a Polish child. He was hung from a tree. And 4 days after, dozens more Jews were shot dead in the street. There is truth, it seems, to Saul's declaration. Eyes turn to Nehuma. She nods in agreement, glancing at her husband, and then down at the map. I agree. We should go. The words are heavy in her lungs, leaving her breathless. It is a declaration she never thought she'd make. 6 years ago, Hitler's proclamation to remove the Jews from the continent seemed absurd. No one believed such cold-blooded plans could come to fruition. But now they know. They've seen the newspapers, the photographs. They've begun to process the numbers. Now, there is no denying what the enemy is capable of. I think it's best, she adds, swallowing. The idea of leaving behind all that was once theirs, their home, their street, their shop, their friends, is nearly impossible to conceive. But Nehuma reminds herself, those things are things of the past, of a life that no longer exists. There are strangers now living in her home. Could she and Saul take it back, even if they wanted to? And who is left of their friends? The ghetto has been empty now for years. As far as they knew, there were no Jews left in Radom. Saul is right. It isn't smart to stay in Poland. History repeats itself. This is one truth of which she is certain. I think so too, Mila says. I want Felicia to grow up someplace she can feel safe, where she can feel normal. Mila frowns, wondering what the concept of normal even means to her young daughter. The only life Felicia knows is one of being hunted, forced into hiding, sneaked through ghetto gates, left in the hands of strangers. She is nearly 7, and all but the first year of her life has been spent in war, with a sickening awareness that there are people who wish her dead just by virtue of her birth. At least Mila and her siblings have the experience to understand that it hasn't always been this way. But the war, the persecution, the daily fight to survive, this is Felicia's normal. Mila's eyes begin to water. Think of everything we've been through, she says. Everything Felicia has been through. There isn't a way to erase what has happened here. She shakes her head. There are too many ghosts, too many memories. Beside Mila, Bella nods, and Jakob's heart aches for her. Hers is an opinion that doesn't need to be spoken. They all know that for Bella, a return to Radom would be impossible. With her parents and her sister gone, there is nothing left for her there. Jakob finds Bella's hand, and as he folds his fingers around hers, he can't help but recall how, in her deepest months of despair, he'd all but lost her. How she had pushed him out of her life. It had torn him apart to see her like that, to watch her disappear. He'd never felt so helpless. Nor had he felt such relief when she finally made the effort, little by little, to pick herself up and to carry on. He'd seen glimmers of the old Bella in Warsaw, but it is this pregnancy, this new life inside her, that seems to have helped her restore the strength she needs, at last, to heal. Jakob glances up at his parents. He can tell from the way his mother seems to be bracing herself that she knows what he's about to say. It's old news. He's told her already that he and Bella are considering a move to the United States, but the words don't come easily. "Bella's uncle in Illinois," he begins quietly, "has agreed to sponsor us. It doesn't guarantee a visa, of course, but it's a start. And it makes sense, I think, to take him up on it. Surely the others understand that at least in the States, Bella could be surrounded by what remains of her family." "Once we get to Chicago," Bella says, looking from Nehuma to Saul, "we can inquire about visas for the rest of the family, if that's something you might be interested in." "We'll stay in Poland for the time being," Jakob adds, "at least until the baby arrives." A sponsorship to America. The idea settles in Nehuma's heart like a lead weight. If it were up to her, she would spend every last hour she had on this earth with her children at arm's reach. But she can't argue with Jakob. It would be foolish of him not to accept help from Bella's uncle. Without a sponsorship, an American visa is nearly impossible to come by. Jakob goes on to explain that no ships are allowed to sail from Europe to the States at the moment, but that restrictions are due to be lifted soon. "Apparently, there are passenger ships leaving from Bremerhaven," he says, leaning over the map and pointing to a city in northwest Germany. "Our thought once the baby is born," he says, "is to make our temporary home a displaced person's camp here in Stuttgart. From there, we should have a better chance of securing visas." Helena stares at Jakob from across the table, her mouth puckered in disgust. She is appalled by the idea of her brother moving to Germany.
"Aren't there DP camps in Poland?" she snaps. "Wouldn't you be better off here?"
She shakes her head vehemently, her green eyes challenging his.
"I'd rather slit my throat than set foot into the belly of evil."
Helena's tone is sharp, but though it might have bothered Jakob before, it doesn't now. It's become her job, he realizes, to protect the family. She's just watching out for him. He meets her stare with a look of understanding, agreeing that the idea of a move to Germany is unnerving. "Trust me, Helena, it won't be easy. But if it means we are one step closer to a new life in the States, then we're ready to do what it takes. At this point, I think it's safe to say we'll have been through worse." The room is quiet for a moment before Helena speaks up again.
"All right then," she declares.
"Jakob, you and Bella have reason to stay. But we don't. I think we've all agreed on that. My vote is we go to Italy, to Genek and Selim. From there we can decide together, as a family, where to go next." She looks to her parents. Nehuma and Saul exchange a glance.
"I only wish we had some idea of whether Adi," Nehuma says, stopping to correct her choice of words, "of where Adi is."
The others grow silent, lost in their own fears, but Nehuma nods.
"Italy."
"We mustn't forget that Mussolini was Hitler's ally during the war," Saul says. "I suggest we find a route with as few civilian checkpoints as possible."
And so the decision is made. For Jakob and Bella to make their way in a few months from Łódź to Stuttgart and eventually, hopefully, to America, and for the others to travel to Italy. As the family leans over the map, Adam traces his fingers from Vuj southwest to Italy, listing the cities in between where he's confident there would be Red Cross offices. Katowice, Vienna, Salzburg, Innsbruck. He omits Krakow, for he's certain his wife would be better off never returning to anywhere within a 50-kilometer radius of the Montelupich prison. The route would require crossing through Czechoslovakia and Austria. They agree that it's their only good option. I will write to Terza, Franca, and Salik to let them know of our plans, Halina says, thinking aloud. I will ask the joint if they can help pay for their travel so that they can meet us in Italy. And I'll talk to the girls at the Red Cross. Perhaps they can help us plan a route or tell us of other Red Cross locations we might not know about along the way. We'll need vodka and cigarettes for the checkpoints. Nahuma looks at Saul, envisioning the journey. To get to Italy won't be easy, but if they can make it, she'll be reunited with her firstborn, and Felicia will have a father. Her mood lightens at the thought. At the start of the war, she had no idea if she and Saul would live to see the end of it, if her children would live to see the end of it, if they would ever come together again as a cohesive whole. The day the Germans marched into Radom, her world was torn to shreds. She'd watched from then on as every basic truth of the life she once knew, her home, her family, her safety, was thrown to the wind. Now, those fragments of her past have begun to drift back down to earth, and for the first time in over half a decade, she has allowed herself to believe that, with time and patience, she might just be able to stitch together a semblance of what was. It will never be the same. She's wise enough to understand that. But they are here, and for the most part, together, which has begun to feel like something of a miracle. Of course, she can't help but fixate on the missing pieces, on Moshe and the family that Saul has lost, and on Adam's relatives, who are still unaccounted for, and especially on the gaping hole that belongs to her middle son. What has become of her Adi? Nehuma's spirit plummets as she grapples with the mystery, the likelihood that she may never know, and the reality that her world, her tapestry, will never be complete without him. Chapter 56. Halina. Austrian Alps, July 1945. Through a clearing in the trees, Halina can see nothing but steel blue sky. It's past 8 in the evening, yet still light enough to read a book, if she had one. Her parents, Mila and Felicia, are asleep, their sweat-caked bodies strewn across the campsite, heads propped on purses and the small leather satchels holding what's left of their belongings. Listening to the drone of a woodpecker on the trunk of a nearby aspen, Halina sighs. It'll be another hour before it's dark, another 2 hours, she knows, before she will surrender to sleep. She might as well take advantage of the last bit of light, she decides, retrieving a handkerchief from the inside zipper pocket of her purse. She unfolds it and arranges her remaining cigarettes into a row on the ground in front of her, counting them. There are 12. Enough, she hopes, to bribe the guards at the next checkpoint. Meet in Bari, Genek wrote in her last correspondence. Despite the heavy restrictions on civilian travel, Halina, Nehuma, Saul, Mila, and Felicia didn't waste much time in leaving Vuj. Adam had stayed behind. You go, he told Halina. I'll stay, earn us some savings. He'd found a steady job at a local cinema. I'll meet you in Italy when you're settled, he said. Halina didn't argue with him. A few weeks before, Adam had found, through the International Tracing Service, the names of his parents, siblings, and nephew on a list of those confirmed dead. There was no other information, just their 9 names inked onto a page amid hundreds of others. Adam was devastated, and the fact that he'd been given no explanation of how or when they died was driving him mad.
Halina knew it wasn't the job he was staying for. He needed answers. And so Halina and the others had left, armed with as many cigarettes and bottles of vodka as they could carry. Halina had hired a driver to take the family to Katowice, a city 200 kilometers due south of Łódź. In Katowice, Halina, still fluent in Russian, finagled a ride in the back of a truck delivering supplies to the Red Army in Vienna. The journey took days. The Kurtzes stayed hidden, tucked between crates of uniforms and tinned meat, afraid that if they were caught crossing borders in Czechoslovakia or Austria without the proper documents, they'd be turned back, or worse, incarcerated. From Vienna, they hitchhiked to Graz, where they were dropped at the base of the southern limestone Alps, a towering snow-capped range that snaked southwest through Austria and into Italy. Halina wondered if her parents and Felicia, still stick-thin, would be able to make the trek. The Alps were imposing, taller than any mountains she'd seen before. But unless they wanted to face a dozen train station and border checkpoints, crossing them on foot was their best option. After a week of rest in Graz, the Kurtzes shed some of their belongings, filled the remaining space in their bags with bread and water, and using what was left of their savings, Adam had insisted they bring what little he had. They hired a guide, a young Austrian boy named Wilhelm, to show them the way over the range. "Your lucky summer came a bit early," Wilhelm said the day they left. "The Southern Alps are covered in snow 10 months out of the year, and this time of year they're usually impassable." They walked every day from 7 in the morning to 7 at night. Wilhelm proved extremely helpful as a guide, until they woke up one morning to find that he'd vanished. Luckily, he'd left the remainder of the food along with his map. Cursing the young Austrian's cowardice, Halina quickly appointed herself leader. She wraps her handkerchief around her cigarettes and slides them back into her purse, then reaches to her breast pocket for the map and peels it open gently by the corners. With all of the use it's gotten, its edges are now velvet soft, its creases unnervingly thin. She brushes a few pebbles from the ground and lays the map down, tracing a dirt-caked fingernail between their approximate location and the nearest town at the foot of the southern Alps, Villach, a village just north of the Italian border. She estimates another 40 hours of walking due south, which means they could be in Italy in 4 days. It will be a challenge. Their lungs have acclimated to the 3,000-meter altitude, but the soles of their shoes, not intended for such frequent, rugged use, have begun to disintegrate. They'll need to be exceptionally cautious, especially in their descent. Halina considers breaking up the trip to give their legs a rest. The day before, Saul had stumbled on a route along the path and nearly rolled his ankle. They are all exhausted to the bone. 12 hours of hiking each day is a lot to ask, but they are also low on provisions, with only 4 to 5 days' worth of bread and water left in their supply at most. So, they'll press on, Halina decides. Best just to get to Italian soil. The others would surely agree. A white-tailed eagle circles overhead, and Halina marvels at its massive wingspan, then eyes the provisions pack she'd hung from a nearby branch, checking to be sure she'd cinched it tightly shut. "Close your eyes," she tells herself. Slipping the map back into her shirt pocket, she laces her fingers together and leans back to rest her head in her palms. Her body is whipped from the day's exertion, but she is too wound up to sleep. Her thoughts, like the incessant drum of the resident woodpecker, come and go in triple time. What if she picks the wrong route down the mountain? They could get lost, run out of food, and never make it to Italy. What if they make it to Italy and are turned back by the authorities? It was only a month ago that the country was occupied by Nazis. What if something happens to Adam in Łódź? It will be weeks, more possibly, before she can write to him with a return address.
Helena stares up at the darkening sky. It's not just the what-if scenarios that are keeping her awake. There's also a part of her that's too excited to sleep. She's just days from reuniting with her oldest brother. She imagines what it'll feel like to see Genek for the first time in so many years, to hear his laugh, to kiss his dimpled cheeks, to sit down together as a family and figure out a plan, where to go next. The idea of setting their minds to a future beyond the war is thrilling, intoxicating. It makes Helena's heart race just thinking about it. Maybe Bella is right. Maybe her relatives could sponsor the whole Kurtz family, and they could move to the States. Or maybe they'll head north, to the United Kingdom, or south, to Palestine, or across the planet to Australia. Their decision, of course, will depend on which country will be willing to open its doors. Quit thinking and sleep, Helena tells herself. As she rolls to her side, she folds an arm into a pillow, resting her head on her elbow, and brings a hand to her low belly. She's 2 weeks late now. She tries to do the math, to count the days since she and Adam saw one another, but it's nearly impossible. She spent so many years thinking ahead that her brain has forgotten how to look back in time. The days before they left Vuč are fuzzy. Could she be? Perhaps. It's possible. But also possible that she's just late. It's happened before. She didn't bleed once during the 4 months she was imprisoned in Krakow. Too much stress. Too little food. You never know, Helena allows herself, smiling. Anything is possible. For now, just get the family safely to Italy. Focus on the task at hand, on the next 4 days. At the moment, she decides, willing her mind to rest, that's all that matters. Chapter 57. The Kurtz Family. Adriatic Coast of Italy, July 1945. Felicia sleeps curled into the fetal position on the seat next to Mila's, her cheek propped on her mother's thigh. Mila, too nervous to close her eyes, rests a hand on Felicia's shoulder and presses her forehead to the window, taking in the azure of the Adriatic as the train speeds south along the heel of Italy's boot toward Bari. She rehearses, for the thousandth time, what she will say to her husband when she sees him. It should be obvious. I've missed you. I love you. So much has happened. Where do I begin? But even in her mind, the words feel forced. Nahuma had told her to be patient, to try not to worry so much, but Mila can't help herself. She wonders if Selim will be the same man she knew before the war, tries to imagine falling back into the rhythm of husband and wife, Selim playing the role once again of patriarch, money earner, keeper of their fate. Could she do that? Could she learn to take a back seat, to depend on him again? It's been just her and Felicia for so long, she's not sure she's ready yet to let someone else take the reins, even if that someone is Felicia's father. Across the aisle, Helena fans herself with a newspaper. She'd begun the trip sitting opposite Mila, but conversing with her sister while watching the scenery stream by in reverse had made her stomach turn, so she moved to a seat where she could face forward. She's pregnant. She's sure of it now. Her stomach heaves when it's empty, her breasts are swollen and tender, and her slacks have grown snug around the waist. Pregnant. It is a truth as daunting as it is thrilling. She hasn't said a word to the family yet. She plans to tell them after they reach Bari. And she'll have to come up with a clever way to share the news with Adam back in Vuč. Perhaps she'll splurge on a telephone call. I've just walked over the Alps and I'm pregnant, she'll say. If someone had told her before the war that at 28, she'd lead her family across a mountain range, pregnant and on foot, she'd have laughed wholeheartedly. She's not a country girl. a 3-week haul over the mountains, sleeping on the dirt, with stale bread and water for sustenance, while carrying a child? Not a chance. Halina replays the past few weeks of their journey in her mind, marveling at the fact that, despite the circumstances, she hasn't heard a single complaint. Not from Mila, who trekked for hours each day with Felicia on her back. Not from her parents, whose limps grew more apparent by the day. Not even from Felicia, whose shoes were so small, her blistered toes had finally poked a hole in one of them, and who, when her mother wasn't carrying her, had to take 2 strides for every one of the adults to keep up. Their border crossing into Italy, thankfully, had been uneventful. "Siamo italiani," Halina lied to the British authorities manning the checkpoint in Tarcento. When the guards balked, Halina opened her purse. "Returning home to our families," she said, reaching for the remaining cigarettes. It was a strange feeling to walk for the first time on Italian soil. Nehuma was the only one in the group who'd been before. She used to visit Milan twice a year to buy silk and linen for the shop. To pass the time, and as a distraction from their aching knees on their descent through the Alps, she told stories of her travels, of how the vendors at the Milanese markets had nicknamed her La Tigre Cieca, the blind tiger, as she would travel from stall to stall, rubbing fabric swatches between thumb and forefinger, always with her eyes closed before making an offer. There was no fooling her when it came to quality. "I could guess the price to the nearest lira," she said proudly. Once in Italy, Halina asked directions to the nearest village. They then walked another 6 hours, depleted of their water supply. It was dusk and they were all close to delirium when they knocked on the door of a small home on the outskirts of the town. Halina could see that they were in no shape to sleep another night out in the elements, with only a crust of bread to eat and nothing to drink, and gave a silent prayer that whoever opened the door would look at their filthy, bedraggled group with sympathy and not suspicion. She breathed a sigh of relief when a kind-eyed young farmer and his wife opened the door and waved them inside. Nehuma was able to talk to them using the small bit of Italian she had, and soon they were devouring warm plates of peppery pasta aglio e olio. That night, all 5 Kurtzes slept better than they had in months, on blankets the couple had spread across the floor. The next morning, after offering up profuse thanks to their Italian hosts, the Kurtzes continued on by foot toward the train station. En route, they crossed paths with a group of American soldiers who stepped out of their army green jeeps when Halina waved and flashed a smile at them. The Americans, one of whom fortunately spoke French, were eager to learn news of the situation in Poland. They shook their heads in disbelief when Halina told them briefly of the unfathomable devastation in Warsaw and the path that she and her family had followed in order to flee their homeland and arrive safely in Italy. Before they parted, a young, blue-eyed sergeant with a T. O'Driscoll patch sewn to his fatigues reached into his pocket and squatted beside Felicia. "Here you are, darlin'," he said in an accent unlike any Felicia had ever heard before. She had blushed as the handsome American handed her a brown and silver foil package. "It's a Hershey bar. I hope you like it," Sergeant O'Driscoll said.
"Merci," Mila said, squeezing Felicia's free hand.
"Merci," Felicia imitated quietly.
"Where to from here?" the American had asked, patting Felicia on the head as he stood.
The soldier who spoke French translated.
"To family in Bari," Halina explained.
"You're a long way from Bari."
"We've gotten pretty good at walking," Halina said, smiling.
"Wait here."
Sergeant O'Driscoll left and returned a few minutes later with a U.S. $5 bill.
"Train's faster," he said,
handing Halina the bill, returning her smile. Across from Halina, Nehuma and Saul drift in and out of sleep, their chins nodding as the train ricochets on its tracks. Studying them as if through Genek's eyes, Halina can see how much the war has aged them.
They looked 20 years older than they had before they'd been locked up in the ghetto, forced into hiding, nearly starved.
Bari, 5 minuti, the conductor calls.
Mila runs her fingertips over the scurvy scars still pockmarking Felicia's neck and cheeks. Her hair is shoulder length now, and blonde from her ears down. Beneath her eyelids, Felicia's eyes jump. Her forehead twitches. Even in her sleep, Mila realizes, her daughter looks scared. The last 5 years have stripped her of her innocence. A tear spills from Mila's eye, down her cheek, and onto the collar of Felicia's blouse, leaving a small stain on the cotton, a perfect gray circle. Mila wipes her eyes, her mind turning again to Selim, to the questions she can't ignore. What will he think of Felicia, the daughter he's never known? What will Felicia think of him? Yesterday, she had asked what to call Selim. How about just father to start, Mila had suggested. A few minutes later, as the train begins to slow, Mila's heart rate hastens. She pleads with herself to embrace the gift of the husband and father she and Felicia are about to receive. Heaven knows what's happened to his family, to his father, a watchmaker of modest means, to his 8 siblings. Last she knew, a sister Eugenia had emigrated to Paris, a brother David to Palestine. The rest, she believed, had remained in Warsaw. She tried to locate them before the uprising, but they'd either left on their own accord or been sent away. She could find no trace of them. It's a blessing, she realizes, to soon be reunited with her husband amid the inconceivable tragedy the war has left in its wake. Most would do anything to be in her position. Brakes squeal. The scenery outside her window slows to a crawl. Mila can see the Bari station 100 or so meters ahead, and on the platform, people, waiting. As she rubs Felicia's shoulder gently to wake her, she makes a promise to herself. She'll embrace her husband with an open heart. She'll paint a picture of stability, no matter how hard it might be, for Felicia's sake. And what happens next? What Selim will think of the girl on her lap with unsightly hair and pink scars running down her face? Whether Felicia will learn to love the man she has no recollection of ever knowing? These are things, Mila tells herself, best left in the hands of fate. Chapter 58. The Kurtz Family. Bari, Italy, August 1945. It's chaos at the Bari station. Bodies, 3 rows deep, crowd the platform. Men in uniform, small children gripping the hands of what appear to be grandparents, women in their best dresses, waving, standing on their toes, the backs of their calves painted with long charcoal lines to give the illusion of stockings. As the Kurtzes make their way from the train, Halina leads. Nehuma and Saul follow close behind, and Mila brings up the rear, the straps of a leather satchel looped over her shoulder, her hand holding tight to Felicia's. They shuffle their feet so as not to step on each other's heels, a body of 5 moving as one.
Let's wait over here,
Halina calls over her shoulder, as they make their way through the throngs to a marquee reading Bari Centrale, and beside it, a sign with an arrow for Piazza Roma. Gathered beneath the marquee, they remain close, standing in a knot, searching the platform for familiar faces. Unaccustomed to seeing Genek and Selim in military garb, they remind themselves to look only for men in Polish uniform.
Kurde, Halina grumbles. I'm too damned short, can't see a thing. Listen for Polish, Nehuma suggests.
There are several languages being spoken on the platform. Italian, of course, and some Russian, French, Hungarian. But so far, no Polish. The Italians are the loudest. They move slowly and talk with their hands, gesticulating wildly.
Can you see anything?
Halina shouts over the din of the crowd. Mila shakes her head. Not yet. She's the tallest of the group. Pivoting in place, she scours the sea of strangers around her, letting her eyes linger occasionally on the back of a head until it turns, revealing a face that bears no resemblance at all to her husband or her brother, then jumping quickly to the next in the mob.
Mamushu,
Felicia calls, squeezing Mila's hand. Yes, darling.
Do you see him?
Mila shakes her head and tries to smile. Not yet, love, but I'm sure he's here. She bends quickly to kiss Felicia on the cheek. As she stands, her eyes catch something in the crowd, and her heart pauses. A profile. Handsome. Tall. Dark-haired, albeit with a hairline that receded farther than she remembered. Could it be?
Genek!
She yells, flailing an arm over her head. Behind her, Nehuma gasps. Genek turns, his eyes bright, scanning the faces in the direction from which he'd heard his name, finally meeting Mila's.
Where? Where do you see?
Halina shouts, hopping up and down. Genek's voice hurtles overhead, somehow audible amid the racket.
Mila!
His arm shoots up over his head, knocking the cap from someone in front of him. He disappears for a moment to retrieve the hat, and when he surfaces again, he is moving toward her.
You stay there! Genek shouts. I'll come to you!
It's him! It's him! It's him!
Halina, Saul, and Nehuma echo each other's elation, bouncing rapidly in place. Hearing Genek's voice is reason enough to celebrate. Mila drops her satchel and hoists Felicia up to her waist. The child has yet to gain back the weight she'd lost in the convent bunker. Mila can easily hold her on her hip with one arm. Mila points to Genek.
You see? Just there. Your Uncle Genek.
He's the handsome one, with the big smile and the dimples. Wave!
Felicia smiles and waves along with her mother.
And father? Is he with him?
Felicia's voice is nearly swallowed in the cacophony. A thought strikes Mila fast and hard, like a mallet to a gong. What if Selim isn't here? What if something's happened since they last corresponded? What if he's gone? What if he hadn't the courage to meet them?
Where are you, Selim?
I don't see your father just yet, she starts.
But as her brother draws closer, she notices a body following closely behind, dark-haired, a head shorter than Genek. She had missed him at first.
Wait, I think I see him. He's just behind your uncle.
Felicia cranes her neck.
You say hello first, she says, suddenly shy.
Mila nods and lowers Felicia to the ground, taking her hand.
Okay. Genek, is he close? Nehuma asks. Is Selim with him too?
Mila turns around to face her mother.
Yes. Selim is with him.
Come, she says, reaching for Nehuma and pulling her gently to stand in front of her.
Genek is nearly here. You should be the first to greet him.
Genek is stuck behind a group of locals. Mila watches as he loses his patience, turns his body sideways, and pushes his way through. A couple of the men yap at him in Italian, but he is unfazed. The tears that have welled in Ahuma's eyes stream down her cheeks like water from a broken dam when she finally sees her eldest striding toward her, even more dashing in his army attire than she remembered him.
Genek!
Is all she can manage when he sees her. His eyes are wet too. He reaches for her and she for him, and they melt together in a long embrace, shaking with laughter and sorrow and raw, uninhibited joy. Nehuma closes her eyes, feeling her son's warmth radiate through her as he rocks her gently from side to side.
I missed you so much, mother.
Nehuma is too emotional to speak. When she finally peels herself away, Genek wipes his eyes with the palms of his hands and beams at his family,
Before he can say a word, Halina jumps into his arms.
You made it, Genek laughs. I can't believe how far you've come.
You have no idea, Halina says.
And you,
Genek beams, marveling at the sight of his